I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing this wonderful journey with us. It's inspiring, really.
People do actually take journeys while they're listening to us. A lot of people like to listen to us on their walks.
Oh, lovely.
Also, the other day someone sent me a picture of some pancakes they were making while they were listening to us.
Well, that sounds great.
Good Sunday morning breakfast making companions, are we? Maybe.
Well, not all.
Not the jolliest of breakfast companions.
No.
When would you listen to us?
I've no idea.
My friend Nathan listens to us when he's cleaning the house.
Gosh. Not sure when I'd listen. Ooh, it's bad enough doing it.
Don't say that.
No, I'm
he doesn't mean it.
I don't. But crikey.
Crikey.
I don't know. I watch and listen to such a lot. Of extraordinary.
It's a bit different for you because it's not. It would be like if you listen to a cricket podcast, when would you listen to that?
Oh, any time of the day.
Yeah, so literally. I guess if you like true crime, you'd listen to it any time.
Yeah, I love true crime. Crikey.
I know, but I mean, if you didn't do it for a job, like if your job was a cricket commentator, you wouldn't listen to cricket podcasts in your spare time, would you? Because you'd do
probably
it all
not,
the time
no.
for work.
No, I probably wouldn't.
And
but
things.
But I do take a great interest, and then, as I was saying last week, Mo, I went back and watched the entire first season of Mindhunter again.
Mm.
Partly because I've been doing a Jerry Brudos film myself, and partly to remind myself just how good it was, which it is. Yeah, it's really very, very good.
Listeners, if you haven't watched Mindhunter.
Oh, please do. It's absolutely brilliant.
Successful,
particularly the last
Netflix
episode of series one, when Ed Kemper is revealed to be slightly more chilling than you might have thought. It's a brilliant, brilliant ending.
Love.
Mindhunter. But I think if you take an interest in this kind of thing, and which I do, and not only do I make films about it, not only do a podcast, but I also review books about it. This is it's an absolutely undying sense of fascination that a lot of people have, and people talk to me about it in the most extraordinary way. I'm really interested, and then they'd say to me things like, "Well, you're talking about these terrible people." And I say, well, you don't have to listen or indeed watch. You can not.
Mm.
Oh, no, but they're fascinating. It's an extraordinary kind of...
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I've got a little thing that I want to raise with you.
Okay.
This a new book is coming out in October, written by a very distinguished, I have to say, very distinguished forensic scientist who's worked for everyone. Police in UK, Home Office, Scottish Parliament. I mean, he's a really, really distinguished. And he writes an author's note, which I was fascinated by. This is a quote. According to Janet Malcolm, the writer and journalist, quotes, every journalist, when writing about murder, who is not too stupid or full of himself to notice what is going on, knows that what he does is morally indefensible. I do not regard what I do as morally indefensible.
I don't agree with that at all.
Neither do I. It was written in 2004, I should say. And it slightly reflects the author's attitude. I mean, he's at pains to describe the media throughout the book as the enemy.
Oh, I see. So he, as a forensic scientist, is able to write about it. And the journalists, because they're not
forensic scientists.
Specialists or haven't trained in criminology,
yes,
or whatever.
And they're always exaggerating the facts.
Oh. Well,
he's entitled to his view.
Entitled to his opinion. I don't agree with it.
Neither do I. But, I mean, I raise it because it does raise an issue that we've talked about before, and that is sometimes we get over fascinated by the perpetrator and we forget the victims.
Forget the victims.
And the victims' families and the people who suffer.
We try not to, but yes, it is. That does happen.
It is. It's a very... It's a very potent question. But I think we've tried throughout, all the time we've been doing this podcast, to be balanced and even and to try and convey the awfulness, the suffering that is. And I don't think, in fact, I know, I do not believe what I do is morally indefensible.
No, I don't. It's definitely not.
But one has to accept that there are maybe people who do.
The problem with that, though, is then you're just saying journalism, in theory, therefore, is morally indefensible because those people who are journalists aren't experts in their field, but that's the whole point of journalism. So there are experts in journalism, which is a skill in itself, so it doesn't really stand up.
No. In what was then still Fleet Street in 1967, I kind of stand up for my inky trade. I've never thought of it as a profession, and I've never thought of us as scientists, but I think we try and convey something about the world, and not always very comfortable world that we find ourselves living in. And we do deal, it's fair to say, darling, isn't it, that we do deal in quite dark thoughts quite a lot of the time here.
We do. Not to change the subject, but just quickly to remind people that we're setting up a Patreon page, and we would love for you to become a member, a patron of ours, if you want to. No obligation. It's we'll still be able to access the podcast for free, and that will never change, and we'll keep doing that. But this is just to kind of give us a bit of support, a little bit of money. All the money will just be invested back into the podcast to help us do a bit more, you know, to get a bit more kit, and we'd love to do a few extra things, interview more people, and we've got lots of ideas, but you know, yeah, so there'll be kind of varying levels of contribution you can make, and you kind of get different things. The basic bit is just supporting us, basically. Yeah. And then if you pay a little bit more, we're going to do a bit of bonus content.
Yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to expand and make it better. I'd love to do a bit more video content. I'd love to do some interviews. I'd love to do, you know, it's just a question of, but the most important point of all, and one I hang on to, is that if you want to just listen to this podcast, you are very, very welcome, and we're very, very grateful to you for listening.
We're very grateful for you for listening. And on that note, we are going to get going with this week's topic, we are calling Heavenly Creatures.
We are calling it Heavenly Creatures, in a tribute to a Peter Jackson film in 1994, which was based on this case. It was suggested to us by one of our listeners in New Zealand.
Uh-huh.
Because it's a New Zealand-based case.
Very good.
It's really quite an old story. It took place, the events took place in June 1954 in Christchurch in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And they involved two teenage girls, Pauline Parker and Juliet Hulme, H-U-L-M-E, Hulme. Both were born in 1938. They didn't know each other at the outset at all. Pauline Parker was a working class girl from New Zealand. And Hulme was from England and didn't arrive in New Zealand until 1948. Her father was rather distinguished. He was a physicist called Henry Hulme, who became rector of the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, the second oldest university in New Zealand. So it's quite a juxtaposition of families. One poor, one really upper middle class, mm-hmm. I suppose you would call them. But by a strange irony, both attended the Christchurch Girls' High School when they were young. And they had something else in common. They both had nasty, debilitating illnesses when they were children. Parker had osteomyelitis and Hulme had tuberculosis. And they bonded over those childhood illnesses. So what we're talking about is two teenage girls
who've had to spend a lot of time in bed on their own.
Yes. And they met And it was this shared medical history that provided the mortar that kept these two bricks together. They could talk about it. And what they did as their friendship grew is they created effectively an elaborate fantasy world entirely of their own, which involved them writing plays and stories about their life and living in a different world. It was, a lot of people were later to call it obsessive. They were obsessed with one another. And we are talking about New Zealand in the mid-1950s here. You know, it was a long time ago.
Mm.
People had very different attitudes to
most things.
And particularly, say, to teenage crushes. Mm. Now, this is one where I think you have more to offer, perhaps, than I. I can tell you the realities, but there's no doubt that this became a very, very obsessive relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Parker's parents began to worry that there might be a sexual element to this. Remember, lesbianism was barely spoken about in the 50s. It was regarded often as a mental illness.
Mm.
Very different days. But nevertheless, Hume and her family were also concerned, but nevertheless allowed the girls to continue to see each other. Parker used to go to Hume's house for overnights and vacations. And it almost seemed as though, and in fact occasionally, that her parents, Hume's parents, remarked that their daughter would almost become ill when Parker wasn't there. The world they created, they rejected Christianity in its kind of obvious form in favour of their own saints and a parallel dimension they called the fourth world as their version of heaven. And they could enter this world only through spiritual enlightenment as a result of their friendship.
That is quite specific.
It is.
In terms of your own universe creation.
Yes, but I'm going to rely on your insight.
Uh-huh.
What have you seen? Have you experienced? Have you ever witnessed anything resembling that level of...
Not that level, but I can see how you would potentially get to that. Well, if you think of the Bronte sisters,
yep,
and brother, they made a whole separate... Well, obviously that was more to do with literary creation and storytelling, but it was very much a world that they lived in.
Mm.
And I know that as a young girl, I definitely had close friendships and, you know, you have special things that bind you, you know, and, you know, make it secret and private in that, you know, it's your own little thing and other people don't know you're in things. So I don't think that that's an impossibility.
But perhaps the times were so different. Do you think it was? I mean, we're talking about when there's still lots of school uniforms and there's no such thing as the 60s and it's just after the war.
Everything's a bit more closed off. Yeah, I mean, I suppose you might want more to create a fantasy world to live in that you felt more comfortable in if you didn't feel comfortable
in your own.
The real world.
Yeah. Well, you can only call it a sort of mélange, a stew of mutual affection.
Mm-hmm.
A terrible stone is dropped into the pond. Hume's mother is having an affair and the parents separate. It's a scandal. He has to resign, her father has to resign as rector of the University of Canterbury, and it's chaos. It's decided that Hume's mother will return to England, where they come from in 1948, and that not with her daughter, however. Her daughter, because of her bad health, was to be sent to another member of the family in South Africa. This all takes place in the first half of 1954. Now, there is absolutely no doubt that Parker was convinced that her mother would never allow her to go to South Africa with Hume, although that's what she desperately wanted to do. She was literally, I mean, Parker was literally heartbroken at the thought of not being together with her. And so they formed a plot to murder Honora, that was her mother's name.
Which mother?
Parker's.
Okay.
The one that wasn't going to allow her to go to South Africa,
yeah,
with Juliet Hume. And what they planned to do was to kill her and go to South Africa and then to Hollywood or New York to pursue their career is writing books and films.
Good plan.
On the afternoon of the 22nd of June 1954, the girls had been having tea with Honora, Pauline's mother, in a little tea place near Victoria Park in Christchurch. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They take off for a walk. It's a sort of woodland walk in the park. And about 130 metres down the path, in a pretty wooded, you know, kind of quite not public area, it's near a little wooden bridge over a stream, they bludgeoned Honora to death with a brick.
Oh,
half a brick wrapped in an old stocking.
Really?
Mm.
That is grim.
Well, if you accept my argument about the obsession, you can see how that might occur.
Yeah, no, it's just the practicality of it. It's just horrible.
Well, they, now, surprisingly, you wouldn't be surprised to hear, the girls were covered in blood.
Yeah.
They would be. Head wounds.
Yeah.
Lots of blood.
Mm-hmm.
So they run back to the tea kiosk. They'd only just left. And say, oh, Honora's hit her head. Oh, so the couple who run the kiosk make a fuss of them, and the police eventually are called. But when the police go and look at the body,
doesn't look like anyone's fallen over.
No, because they've got lacerations to the head, neck and face as a result of the brick in an old stocking. And it doesn't take them very long, and it isn't very far away, for them to discover the murder weapon.
That's not
half a brick in an old
stocking.
That's
not well thought out, the plan, is it?
No, but remember, these are 15 and 14. I mean, yeah, we are talking about... I'm just checking. Pauline at that point was 16 and Juliet was 15. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
When the murders took place. So the police find the murder weapon and, of course, arrest the girls. I mean, there can't be anybody else. They're charged. At that point, and this is a detail you don't need to worry yourself with, but Honora had been calling herself Reaper, R-I-E-P-E-R, because the man she was living with at that point was called Reaper. But actually, they weren't married. So during the trial, Honora and Pauline are both called by Honora's maiden name of Parker. But it's just easier not to get that confusion involved too soon.
Yeah, yeah.
Her father, Herbert, and her mother were not married. The trial, as you might imagine, in the 1950s, was a sensation.
Yeah, wow.
These two teenage girls, there were all kinds of accusations, the discussions of insanity, discussions of lesbianism, it's discussions of wicked practices.
Sensational.
Yeah, I mean, it's got sensational literally written all over it.
Mm.
And for their part, the girls, I think, probably were dazed. I don't think they truly knew what they'd done.
No, I don't think you do at that age.
I don't think they realise the enormity.
Yeah, I often think that about young people who commit crime.
Of the enormity of their crime. And
what the consequences will be.
Yes, yeah. I mean, and it is. You can see the energy that they would have focused on. We must do it. We must do it.
Because we need to be together. We have to be together. About any of the other. They're not thinking about anything else. Yeah.
They were both convicted on the 28th of August 1954. It took them barely 3 months to convict the girls of the crimes.
Mm.
But because of their age, they couldn't. They weren't subject to the death penalty, which was still available in New Zealand at that time. And they were both sentenced to 5 years.
Hmm.
The story has a very long tale. In 1959, when they were released...
Go ahead.
In 1959, when Hume was released, she joined her father in Italy. Parker was placed on parole for 6 months. She had to remain in New Zealand for 6 months, but then she left the country. She too left the country.
Mm-hmm.
Parker was given a new identity, as Mary Bell was, another case we've done in the past, as Hilary Nathan, and she left for England. And in 1997, she was living near Strood in Kent, running a children's riding school. She'd become a devout Roman Catholic and had never spoken to the press, ever.
Did she ever see Hume again?
No.
No. That's so sad.
Her sister released a statement in the early 2000s expressing Parker's remorse for killing her mother, with, I think, a very telling sentence. It took her 5 years to realise what she'd done. Parker, in the end, went back to New Zealand, where she still lives. Hume went to England and then to the US and then returned to England again. She became a Mormon.
Mm.
She also became an extremely successful historical detective novelist.
No way.
With another name.
Ah.
In fact, she's been called the Queen of Victorian Crime.
Cool.
She lived in Scotland and then left for Hollywood.
No way. And she went to follow her dreams.
She's sold more than 25 million books and written 47.
That's a lot of books.
In March 2006, she issued a statement which said that while her relationship with Parker was obsessive, they were not lesbians. It is, and she too is still alive.
Amazing.
All those years ago and all those dreadful events are long behind both of them.
Mm.
And indeed, the reality of what happened to Hume didn't really begin to surface until Peter Jackson, later to become famous as director of Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, decided to make a film about their case called Heavenly Creatures, which, believe it or not, was the first time we saw Kate Winslet on the screen. She played Hume.
Oh, should go back and have a look at that.
Yes, do. They give their fantasy world a name, which I don't think they'd given at the time, but, except the Fourth World. Mm. But they gave it a country name. The lady who played Parker's career didn't blossom, but the lady
not,
who... But
not Kate, in the same way.
Kate Winslet certainly did.
Ada Winslet.
And if you look them up on IMDb, there's... It wasn't really until that point that people realised that Hume had become a novelist.
Oh, how interesting.
It was quite...
IMDb.
Yes. Sorry, Molly is consulting her.
IMDb.
Her trusty phone, looking up.
Oh, you're not quite right there. Melanie Lynskey, who plays Pauline Parker, is very successful.
Is she? I never knew. Well, it's typical of my ignorance. But it's interesting. If you
she's
look
not
at
an Oscar winner like Kate Winslet, but no, she is very successful.
But if you
she's
look at the pictures of her, of the couple, original couple, they're remarkably alike. They really are.
Creatures, true story. Oh, yeah.
Very clever piece of casting. The film, of course, did very well. I think it got nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay.
Ah. Interesting.
And it turned Jackson from being a cult director of B-movies, horror B-movies, into mainstream.
Yeah. Well, it did a lot for lots of people's careers then.
Yes, it did indeed. And this story, I mean, I find it, because it's difficult for a father and a man to understand this level of closeness, that
do men not have close relationships
not in quite the same way. I'm immediately trying to think of a serial killers who work together, but this is only one crime.
It's not really the same thing as the other.
No, but this is a really extraordinary case. I use the word extraordinary too often, but an amazing case of this obsession that we must be together at all costs and we'll kill to be together.
Mm.
It's an amazing one.
Quite sweet, really. I mean, not the killing part. But.
No, it is.
Well, that was really interesting. Thank you. That was Heavenly Creatures.
Yes.
One.
It is. It's a very, very interesting.
I shall watch the film.
It's a very interesting story. Mm. With a long, as I said, a very long tale. So let's talk about something cheerful, darling. There must be something. Well, lockdown has not been.
Lockdown's not been lifted. Well, the world is. I don't really know.
Struggling back to life.
Well, as long as my, not to make it all about me, that's bad, I shouldn't say that. I was just about to say, as long as my clients are working, but that is so irrelevant in comparison
to
lots of other
I'm
things.
I'm working.
You are working, and a few other people are, and it's good to know that entertainment is still being made so that people have something to watch when they're locked
well,
down.
I would say that one of the things that I was going to mention to you was that the ITV three-part drama on Dennis Nielsen starts this month.
Oh, does it now?
So I've watched the trailer. So I think it's perhaps we ought to do...
Nielsen.
Because a lot of people won't know the reality.
Yeah, okay.
Of the case. And do we do it in one part or two parts?
Oh, don't know. You tell me. It depends how much info there is to get through.
There's quite a lot.
There's quite a lot of victims, aren't there?
Yes.
Well, maybe two.
I've got a feeling it's two.
Let's do two.
And so I think we should do that sooner rather than later.
Well, I would say the next two episodes will be...
I would have thought.
Listeners.
Yes.
It will be Nielsen.
Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
The Nielsen show, which stars David Tennant as Nielsen, is called Dez, which is the name that Nielsen was known as in prison.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm interested to watch that. I'm sure it'll be good. He's a very good actor.
Well, it'll be very, very interesting.
Mm, okay, well, we'll cover
so
that.
So that sort of, that was my extra add-on. That's not very cheerful, sorry.
No, that's not very cheerful. That's just more death.
More death, but I've been completely immersed in...
Have you watched anything else? Have you been watching anything that isn't death-related?
No.
No.
Really? Not to be honest.
Just the whole of Mindhunter again.
Well, yeah, I did watch 8 eps of that. 10 eps, sorry. I haven't started on series 2 again yet.
No, well, you might do something else.
I might. I might look at The Politician you recommended.
Oh, yeah, you should. It's in the second series, it's got Bette Midler in it, and I reckon anything with Bette Midler
it's got to be good.
Worth a watch.
Yeah, I once went to see Bette Midler long ago.
God, she's great.
In the 70s.
I can't get... There is a song called Perfect Isn't Easy from Oliver and Company, which is the Disney version of Oliver Twist.
Okay.
Which Dan and I used to watch when we were kids. And the switch up is Oliver is a cat, a kitten, who's abandoned in New York City. And he is taken in by Sykes. That's not Sykes, sorry. Yeah, Sykes. No, he's the bad guy, Fagin. And he has a band of dogs. And so, like, Dodger is a dog. And he has, like, a band of other dogs with him. And he, like, gets enveloped into this gang. And then he gets lost and he gets rescued by this little girl who lives in, like, uptown posh Manhattan or whatever. Anyway, she has another dog called Babette, who's a poodle played by Bette Midler. And she has this song called Perfect Isn't Easy, But It's Me. And it goes round and round. Yeah, you can. And it goes round and round in my head, that song, pretty much the entire time. Probably because I'm always seeking perfection and not getting it.
Well, I shall have to listen to it.
It's really good.
And I haven't got any great plans except to keep working, really.
Good.
Keep pushing on.
Put one foot in front of the other. That's what I say.
Yeah, and but on the other hand, I do find the podcast incredibly comforting. It's nice to know that there are people out there whom you hope giving some pleasure to and some interest to creating some interest.
I hope so. On that note, thank you very much to all the people that help us. Our producer, Sam Brain, Audio Boom for hosting us and looking after us generally. To my brother, Dan, who did the music, my friend, George, who drew our caricature, to Jeffrey, who does all the hard work every week, and to you, the listeners. Without you, we're nothing.
Absolutely. And I could not be more grateful to you for your enthusiasm and your loyalty. It's incredibly moving. And as I say at the end of each episode, sadly, bad things happen to good people, so do be careful out there.